Interview with Commander Stan Parker, RCN, 12 May 1997. Commander Parker, if we could start this morning by you telling us when you first joined the RCN and giving us a brief overview of your time in the service prior to joining Annapolis as XO in 1965.
I joined in 1945, just as the war was coming to an end, because I wanted to go regular force rather than RCNVR. And so there was a slight delay in getting in. And so the war was, in fact, over by the time I showed up at Cornwallis for my new entry training. Was selected for commissioning and was sent to the RN for training. And spent a few years over there. Came back in time for shortly before the Korean War started. And the first ship I joined was sent to Korea to start with. And I had visions of being a gunnery officer, but no one else agreed with my dream, and they preferred that I be a navigator and kept giving me navigation jobs in various ships, but I was either too dull or too stubborn to take them up on it, so I stayed Salt Horse. I had an interest in damage control and seamanship, so I ended up doing a damage control specialist course, which was sort of a non-specialist. And taught ashore and at sea, and again on exchange to the UK, came back to Canada and joined Annapolis in 65 as her XO, relieving the chap who'd commissioned her the year before. And then we started the trials with the helicopters. The original trials Sagny had been doing. And they were still having trouble with the hull-down device, so they tried a new system with us, and the tensioning of it, and we finished off the trials of that part, and then started working out how do we handle this great big beast on board, because it's what really surprised us once it was on the flight deck. It was as big as a Dakota C-47, and we had to fit it into our tiny little ship.
Right.
We're still thinking in terms of a destroyer, which was just over 2,000 tons. So, and we have to provide all the flight deck crew, not the air detachment, but the flight deck support, such as firefighters and rescue crews and that sort of thing, and still run the ship as a normal warship. So that took us some trials, and it was interesting to see where people had to be hauled from in order to stand by the helicopter launch or recovery. So it was made for some interesting times, but in the end it all worked. And as I mentioned before we turned the tape on, we could not increase the ship's company because there were no more bunks. We were full with just a normal operational ship and the air detachment bunks, and that was it. No more space, so we had to make do with what we had.
All right. Well, perhaps if we can just go back for a moment. You said that you had been overseas in Korea during the Korean War. What ship were you in then?
I was in HMCS Soo.
Do you remember landing a helicopter aboard Soo during the Korean War?
She didn't land. She did do a pickup of an injured Korean seaman that we had taken off a Korean minesweeper, and we reinforced the roof of the squid magazine, which was on the upper deck in that ship, and said, if you want to put down, you could put down here, but remember, there's something like 220 tons of high explosive just under your wheel. So he hovered inches off the roof of the squid magazine, but I don't remember him actually touching down and putting the weight of the bird on it.
All right. It must have been quite a sight to see, though, having this helicopter attempt this rescue hovering just over the roof of the squid magazine. I mean, that would have been probably the first occasion that a helicopter had ever attempted this with a Canadian destroyer.
It was the first time I'd ever seen one.
Right, okay.
You know, we've seen movies of them and pictures and what have you, but actually seeing one flying, and she came in from dead astern. We were had the wind slightly off the bow. I was on watch on the bridge, so I wasn't watching that. I was watching where we were going, but we had to make sure that we got the wind, the funnel smoke, just clear of the from dead astern, so that he could come in from dead astern, follow up our wake, and then hover down. Pat Benson was the XO, and he was the one who was mostly concerned with it because of all this high explosive.
I'm sure. Very tricky operation. But that all went well. I seem to remember reading somewhere, too, that there was another helicopter. They were, one was off the port side, I think. Do you remember two of them at all, or just the one?
I can only remember the one. I might not have been involved with the second one, but I was second. Matter of fact, I was Bob Pierce's second officer of the watch during that.
Oh, were you?
Yeah.
Okay.
And of course, he was my CO during the initial trials in Annapolis some years later.
So the helicopters had provided sterling service for extrication of injured personnel and pilots and plane guard duties, and now this was the RCS.
Oh, I recall what you're thinking of. You know, when we were operating in the LOC, we had, this during Korean War, one destroyer was always taken from the screen during flying operations from the carrier to sit off her starboard quarter as plane guard. And the Americans stopped doing that. They wanted the destroyers on the screen. And they used a helicopter. And everybody thought this was a splendid... And in fact, they sent one over, I think, at one time. We were usually chased off to do the job in Sioux as a plane guard. And during a hurricane, we lost our seaboat. It got smashed all to pieces, and the davits got torn out of the deck, so we couldn't just buy another one and fit it on. So we couldn't do the job anymore. So the Americans loaned a helicopter to do the job for us, and we thought that was a much better way of doing it than having a destroyer there.
Right.
So now I remember what you mean about the other helicopter, yeah.
Right. If we could just move forward now, you had taken over for the XO who was involved with Annapolis's commissioning. Do you remember that officer's name?
It was Jim Cummings.
Jim Cummings,
yeah,
all right.
Now a retired Commodore.
So that would have been late 64 that Annapolis commissioned? Would that be?
Yeah, it's the summer or fall of 64.
64.
He was promoted at the January promotions. And I was on the Admiral's staff because there was no ship for me.
Right.
And so, zoom, I got...
So then you were...
Annapolis.
Into Annapolis. And that would have been January of 1965?
Yeah.
Now, do you remember when Annapolis took over the trials from Assiniboine? Assiniboine had gone in to have her hangar enlarged following her trials with the Sea King. And Annapolis took over in 65.
Yeah, we it was almost immediately after I joined the ship that we started getting the VX-10 people on board and ferry aviation's people fiddling around with the haul-down device.
Right.
It was the winch that was causing the problems. And one of the things is they kept breaking the haul-down wire. And in those first 6 weeks I was aboard, each time they broke it, that as far as they were concerned, it had been overstrained and wherever it had parted, but it so they took it off the reel and it was no longer of use to them. And it was stainless steel. So being the XO and my deck officer and my chief bosun's mate said, "What splendid stuff this is," and we replaced all the upper guardrails in the ship with stainless steel guardrails. Our maintenance problem on guardrails, of course, went right down.
Who would have been responsible for replacing the haul-down cable? Would that have been...
That was Ferry Aviation.
Ferry Aviation would have done that themselves.
Yeah, this is all part of the...
ship's company would have had no involvement or the engineer
officer?
No, we
were not involved, no. All we did was just glom onto this stuff that is good.
I know that Annapolis was tasked to carry out the heavy weather trials and the night trials. Were there any local trials that were done with Annapolis?
Oh, yeah. The continuous haul-down business, and we swung around Deboy in Halifax Harbor for days on end, and while they fiddled around with the tensioning devices. And I don't know how many weeks that went on, but it seemed to go on endlessly, but it probably finished off the winter. One notorious day, we went out for heavy weather trials, and it was dead flat calm. This can't happen off Nova Scotia in dead winter. So the engineer officer reversed our fin stabilizers to make the ship roll.
Right.
To simulate heavy weather.
And how did that work out?
We got some spectacular rolls out of the ship, and it looked kind of peculiar because here we were rolling our guts out and it was dead flat calm.
But this would fit the need for VX-10 and the pilots for carrying out the trials.
Mm, yeah, this was all meeting their... They set the trials agenda, VX-10 did.
Right, okay.
And we were simply at their disposal. You know, sail when they needed us to sail and swing around the buoy when we needed to be around the buoy.
Now, for clarification, you said Halifax Harbor. Would that have been Bedford Basin or Halifax Harbor?
No, right, just north of George's Island.
All right.
There was a trot of buoys there, and one of them had a none of them had telephones until we got there, but VX-10 wanted us on the end of a telephone, so they wired in a phone system to the buoy.
And this was so they could have been in contact with Shearwater?
Yeah, so that they could talk back and forth without having to go through the comm centers.
Right.
Because the ship did not talk to Shearwater. It talked to the Admiral staff and by radio or voice radio to the harbor control.
Right.
And then they'd have to relay the messages to Shearwater. So they said, well, put a phone in and we can phone straight over. So that's what we ended up. That boy had a phone on it for years after.
Really? Mm. Well, that's interesting. How many, or do you have any recollections of personnel swarming all over the ship for the trials? Ferry aviation personnel, VX-10, Doughty?
There was never a huge number. There'd be maybe half a dozen from ferry aviation, sometimes down as far as two. There was an engineer from VX-10, the air engineer, whose name escapes me at the moment. Stretch Arnold was there for a while. And then he went off to other projects. The ones that the Sosnikovsky, the Vitnew, and Hallis are the three officers whose names are always with me.
Right.
And so I must have had more to do with them
than anyone else.
Than anybody else, yeah.
When you were talking earlier about the problems with the winch down system and the cable, do you have any recollections of personnel from that subcontractor, Doughty, being in the ship to work with their systems?
As far as I was concerned, they were all part of the contractor. And
right.
I didn't deal with them directly at all. They were dealing with VX-10.
So when you were doing the local trials or you were tied up to a buoy in Halifax Harbor, were you starting to work through some of these problems of ship's company and manning?
And
you were doing that right from the start then? So what was your concern as XO? What were you trying to balance?
There is a normal ship's work to be done, so you couldn't take people from one department. You say, well, you couldn't take all the bosuns because they had their own thing. You couldn't take all of the ops people. You couldn't take too many from the engine room department. So we have to say, all right, we worked it up to every department would supply one or two, even the supply department people. And when we piped to flying stations, that person would have to drown tools and go to flying stations. And that's how we eventually evolved it into, in fact, we had two watches of them, so that if somebody happened to be on watch, then his oppo would go instead.
Right. Okay.
And that worked out. I know we had a steward who was serving in the wardroom pantry, and it was some time later, but it comes to mind because the helicopter lost an engine while she was some distance from the ship. We were down in the Caribbean. And so there was a get home and get home fast. And So we piped the flying stations as soon as they raised the alarm from the bird. And he just sort of downed tools in the pantry, and whoever was about to be served didn't get served. I think he was one of the rescue divers.
Okay.
But he said, I've got to go. No, sorry.
So ship's company were providing or were tasked to carry out fire duties,
mm-hmm.
and the divers for the rescue divers.
Yeah, we had two rescue divers dressed for each deployment each time, and we had, if I remember correctly, three fire parties of three men each, and we had one on each side of the quarterdeck, and in fact we had sloping ladders put at the after end of the flight deck,
right,
for them to be able to rush up and still be out of clear of the bird as it came in, so they could be under the overhang.
All right.
And then rush out. And we had one in the hangar, from so they could come from both directions.
Now, were they using just CO2 or?
No, we had a foam firefighting system that we had brought out. We purchased from the Americans, and they had that they'd used in their carriers, and they came out with a small one for the Coast Guard for their small helicopters, which we reckon was too small. So we put two of these in tandem to operate our foam system, and it could either operate on the foam, it was called a foam proportioner, and I can't even remember the but it mixed with the firefighting, with the water main pressure, you just switch on the foam proportioner and it'd dump enough foam into the system.
So that would have been two tanks then, but three hoses, would that be correct?
There was one tank, but two pumps.
Two pumps, all right.
And it hit the two standard firefighting hoses.
All right.
And so that you could, instead of the old system of having a 5-gallon bin on the upper deck and you stuck a probe in,
mm-hmm.
and that got your foam, you ran this from a big tank. It was up between the funnels.
All right.
And held quite a bit of foam. I can't remember, maybe 200 gallons of it or something like that. It was quite big.
So that was externally mounted then?
No, inside.
Inside.
Built into the ship.
All right, okay. Was there any fire suppression inside the hangar, sprinklers to distribute foam?
And that went from the foam as well.
All right, so that would have been in the underside of the roof in the hangar?
Yeah.
All right.
The upper part of the hangar. And then these hydrants, and if I remember correctly, there was a hydrant each side inside the hangar that worked off it, and then there were the two hydrants at the after end of the flight deck, below the flight deck level.
All right.
Where the two other two fire parties. And of course, they always had to be dressed for this job. They couldn't.
Were they in fire retardant suits?
Yeah.
All right. So there was three teams of three men each. Mm-hmm. That's considered one watch. Then mm-hmm. there would be another watch mm-hmm. of nine men.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Plus the two divers.
Plus the two divers.
Yeah.
And they would. Where would they be normally located?
The divers usually sat near the rescue David on the starboard side. And let's see. I'm trying to remember. That's a long time back. They were right outside the door to the one of the aircraft maintenance shops.
All right.
And so they tended to keep the after end of the upper deck, where the after gun and handling room would have been in the normal circumstances, or at least in the pre-conversion ships, Annapolis was built as such. They had the ready room, they had a couple of workshops and passageway, and this is where, and the diving stores, so this is where they were.
All right.
But they had to be dressed before in their wetsuits.
So that was my next question. They were dressed in wetsuits with external tanks.
Yeah.
All right.
They had their tanks all ready to go.
Okay. So if they had to go into the water to rescue a pilot and air crew from a downed seeking helicopter, they would have been diving into pretty cold water even with the wetsuits,
mm-hmm.
and in perhaps a pretty heavy sea.
Well, it depends where we had a double thing. We always had a lifeboat's crew or seaboat's crew as part of the watch on deck, and if the helicopter was any distance away, we would launch the seaboat with the divers in it.
All right.
if it was anywhere close, you know, right alongside the ship, then the divers would just step over the side.
Were they attached in any way to the ship by a line?
They carried a rescue coit on a line from the Rescue David, and it was really a sling that you could fit under somebody's arms and hoist them up with.
Oh, I see.
Padded sling, and it floated.
All right.
And they tow this behind them on a short, less, about a fathom of light line, and the boat's crew would have then manned the Rescue David, made sure the line paid out freely to the diver as he was swimming away.
All right.
And they could move quite quickly in the water.
So I assume that both the fire duty and the rescue divers were practicing continuously while the haul down trials were going on as well.
Yeah, we did a lot of practice out at the damage control school out at Sandwich Battery.
All right.
And in fact, they built us a boilerplate mock-up of a helicopter. So that they could keep burning it without it all disintegrating away.
Right.
They were out there, you know, whenever we were in harbor, we'd run out and run drills out there.
All right. So. Was the decision reached that three teams of three men were required for fire duty? Was that sort of trial and error, or?
Well, at one stage they thought four. Of two each, and really two men could not handle a hose up one deck, even a sloping ladder.
All right.
Especially if the shift, they really needed the third man on the hose, so okay, three men on the hose, one to actually handle the nozzle, and the other two to drag this whipping hose around, because it's got a lot of power in it.
And the same would apply for the three-man team that was in the hangar?
Yeah.
Although I assume that their job would have been slightly easier because they didn't have to climb the ladder. They're already on flight deck level.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. So how did this affect the normal working of the ship by having 11 men on each watch being taken away from other duties?
Well, they only were taken away when we went to flying station. So they were not piped to flying stations until the bird was wheeled out and the rotor spread, and then they'd say, okay, we've now tested it up, and we'd go to flying stations. They'd warm up the engine, or start the engines, and do a standard pre-launch check in the cockpit, and then take off, and as soon as they were happy, we'd stand down the fire station, the flying station, and you had 2 hours. Basically, sometimes it was less than that, but basically it was 2 hours before they came back again.
Right.
So they'd go back to work.
Okay.
And it could be that if we didn't launch until 11 o'clock in the morning, that when the bird came back, the other watch would be on.
Oh, I see. Right.
And so nobody interfered with their meals or anything like that.
Would the fire crews be there for refueling operations? In the hangar, for example?
No. We tried once a hot refueling, and we had them there then. So she just came over and hovered over and she didn't even touch down. She hovered over the flight deck.
Right.
And fueled there, and we had them closed up for that because, for all intents and purposes, we had the helicopter that close to the ship.
Mm-hmm.
But the normal fueling, and once the bird was in the trap, on the bird trap, it was holding the bird, then it was secure on deck. The aircraft detachment, the helicopter detachment, personnel would look after the bird from there, and then our people would disperse.
All right, okay.
Just put the hoses away and hang up their suits and go back to work again.
Now, I had talked with a number of other individuals who had made mention of the fact that during the Assiniboine trials, what they found was that the fire suppression systems were inadequate for the job, and what they required was additional volume or capacity, I suppose, for pumping the foam in case there was a fire in the hangar or on the flight deck or during refueling whatever. Were those modifications already incorporated
yeah,
into that, Annapolis?
Yeah, those were the foam perversters we had. I'm going to just plug the coffee in.
So these proportioners that you're talking about were fitted in Annapolis, and then that was an improvement or a modification that came out of the Assiniboine trials?
Yeah, must have been, because they were already fitted in the ship when as built.
All right. Do you, during your time as XO, were there ever any incidents that you remember where they had to use the fire suppression system?
Nope.
No?
No, never used it in anger, no.
So they were only practicing then,
yep.
During the time that you were aboard. Would the hot refueling, was that the first time that it was done with the seeking that you can remember?
That's the first time. We tried it just the once.
All right.
And this, again, was part of the trial system. We'll find out. We were in the Caribbean when we did that. And so that was it was another part of the ongoing thing.
Right. How was everybody, or what was everybody's perceptions of that particular operation, if you can remember? Were they happy with the outcome of the
operation? Yeah, they seemed to be pretty happy with it. From my point of view, I thought it was pretty dicey, the whole thing, but the X-10 seemed to be happy with it.
All right. Perhaps you could speak to that. Why did you think it was a dicey operation?
Well, they did not... The bird was pretty close, well, to start with, maybe 10 feet above the flight deck.
Right.
And she was not over the center of the flight deck. She was off to one side where he could watch, the pilot could watch what was happening ahead.
Right.
Because he was pretty close to the hangar. The rotors are close to the hangar. And I just thought, well, you know, you're too damn close for too long.
Mm-hmm.
And being a seaman, I don't particularly like somebody being that close aboard for that length of time.
Now, I suppose it's all relative when you're talking about this sort of thing. How long would that operation take normally, if you can use that word?
I don't suppose that we ran it for more than a half an hour at the outside. And it really was connect up, start pumping, stop pumping, and disconnect and fly away again. So half an hour at the outside would have been, well, they were figuring out what to do, I suppose, or working out. Yeah. The plan wasn't quite what you had to do at the time. You always had to lower a grounding strap first.
Mm-hmm.
And that had to be touch the deck and ground and the static charge between the ship and the aircraft neutralized, and then hoist up the hose. As I say, it struck me as pretty dicey, but then I was not an airman, I was a simple sailor.
Now, this, I assume, was all done to see how much time could be saved as opposed to the normal method for refueling?
Oh, yeah.
Where they'd actually land the aircraft on the flight deck, have it secured in the bear trap, then start the fueling operation, either with the engines running or shutting down the engine?
Well, we did a trial of that, too. Can we fuel it with the engines running and the rotors turning?
But secured into the bear trap
but
on
in the
deck.
Bear trap. And I don't know how many times we did that. We did that at least once. But the normal method was bring her aboard, shut her down, do a complete washout of the engines from the salt spray and everything. They use fresh water to wash everything off. And then fuel her for another sortie. This was to see whether you could keep the thing airborne continuously. And in fact, one of the hot refueling, I don't know if it's the same one or another one, on the deck, we changed air crews.
All right.
Yeah.
So a complete swap then.
A swap, but the time on deck was minimum because the engines didn't stop. And this was, again, how long can you keep the bird going if you're onto a hot contact and has to get back?
Right.
But was running out of gas or whatever. We didn't try a refueling or a rearming thing during that, but that would have been the next.
the next stage for the next step.
The next step would have, can we trundle out a couple more torpedoes and get the whole thing back up again?
Right. Okay.
Because we were only running one helicopter, and in fact, when we were operating, we were the only ship in the Navy that had a helicopter.
Right.
Then when we got rid of the X-10 and got the detachment on, we were in fact the only operational aircraft carrier Canada had.
All right, we'll just stop the tape here and we'll turn over to the other side.
Okay.